Afternoon. This is the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Today is May 18th, it says on my cheat sheet here. We are going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 862. And would you help us a little get started with what this is?
Of course, Chair Jensen. Senate Bill 862, for the record, has a fiscal statement issued that is in your packets in front of you. The measure authorizes the Department of Forestry to enter into contracts to supply woody biomass from state forest lands as needed to facilitate the development of projects, including bioenergy projects. It directs the State Forester to assess types of woody biomass available and serve as an information resource for persons seeking to use the biomass for energy development. There's also a dash A3 amendment in front of you that was submitted by Representative Thompson for one of his constituents. So it's his constituent's email, and he's, I believe, here to discuss that amendment. But the amendment stipulates that the State Forester may not enter into a contract to supply the woody biomass to a facility located within 10 miles of an education institution or to any facility for the production of synthesized gas, hydrogen pellets, ammonia, mustard gas, or nerve gas.
Okay, and we would start out and ask David Marmon, if you would please, Department of Forestry.
Co-Chair Jensen, Co-Chair Clem, member of the committee, my name is David Mormon. I'm the Director of the Forest Resources Planning Program at the Department of Forestry, and I'm here to testify in support of the A. Gross version of Senate Bill 862. The testimony that's being passed out to you summarizes our general summary of what we think the bill covers, and I won't go into detail on that, except I do want to highlight a couple of points. There was quite a bit of press about the passage of this bill out of the Senate chamber, specifically talking about the call for an assessment, or as some people refer to it as a biomass inventory. And we thought it would be appropriate through our written testimony to put into the record what we think that means so that we can get everybody's expectations on the same page. We believe that with the resources that we will hope to obtain through the governor's recommended budget, the assessment that we will be able to perform will be a one-time, fairly coarse statewide overview of woody biomass availability.
Thank you.
If there's an expectation that it'd be something more detailed, particularly at the level that could be used to base investment decisions, we're probably unlikely to be able to provide that level of inventory with our anticipated resources. So we just wanted to make that clear as you're contemplating this bill, what we think we can deliver. We also point out in the bill that, or in our testimony, that an alternative that might be fruitful to pursue is making greater use of, rather than having the department conduct a fairly coarse assessment of biomass availability, to work with existing mature local collaborative groups who may already have investors at the table working on local solutions to increase biomass utilization, and direct resources at that local scale where maybe they can do those detailed assessments or inventories that could lead to those kind of investment decisions. And finally, I think the other point just to highlight in our written testimony is that I think it's appropriate to maybe look at biomass policy decisions within the broader context of where do we want to go with forest restoration and forest management in the state, where do we want to go with forest sector economic development, and often these discussions quickly bridge over into federal forest management policy, all of which are really not addressed specifically in this bill, but I think eventually we would need to address if we were going to go down the path too far of trying to promote increased woody biomass utilization. Often, I think these prescriptions for wildfire risk reduction and forest restoration may include the removal of larger material, which could actually help fund the removal of the smaller biomass material. Otherwise, it ends up being largely a subsidized activity, which I'm not sure we can afford. But in that context, we really wanted to highlight, I guess, the two main points of what we think we can accomplish with the bill's charge for a biomass assessment with existing resources and kind of some ideas about how you might want to consider this in a broader context. Be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Shopworth.
Thank you. You mean when you say remove some of the larger material, would that be logs that go to a mill and be turned into a lumber?
Yes, very much so. I think a lot, in many cases, the I think particularly when you're talking about Eastern Oregon, these kind of decisions need to be made on a very site-specific basis. If you're familiar with Eastern Oregon, you can walk 100 feet and the forest changes. But in many cases, I think even the science is going to say that the prescription that may be needed on some sites to restore those to a more fire-resilient condition, a more healthy condition, actually also involves the removal of larger material, which in some cases can actually make the operation pay for itself.
Mr. Chair, may I
follow up?
Yeah, forgive me, my tone is rather facetious, because what a revelation. Remove a tree from the forest and actually mill some lumber out of it. That's a great concept, and you have my full support in that. Thank you for coming. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Other questions? No, okay. Thank you very much.
We have to actually remove some larger material.
Miguel Escarins, and I probably butchered that pretty badly, and
no,
my apologies.
Sir. My name is Miguel Escarins.
Okay. Please, proceed.
As you will detect, I'm not a good speaker. I hardly speak, but I will try to communicate my feelings. And as you can see, I requested some amendments to Bill 862.
Thank you.
Because I felt that the language was not concrete. It was vague. Now it's changing more, the bill. They call it now projects. So I would like to ask, what's projects? Just by changing it from units of energy or bio refineries, like I was before, it seems all that wording is being deleted. And in exchange, they are going to say, somebody dream up, let's say projects. So people, the common people like me, won't detect what's that for. And it really, we know the woody biomass, the way the bill is presented, it will be used for these chemical plants, because they are chemical plants. And why the reason I asked to be away from schools, I live in Dallas, Oregon, and there is a proposal to build a 32.2 megawatt gasification plant. Biomass. If anybody will study what a gasification plant is, it will cause risks, especially if it's built next to a high school. How could anybody dream to put such a plant near next to the high school? I mean, it's facts, these plants they have in the United States. Like if we check the McNeil in Vermont, Burlington. It's a plant about 50 megawatts, and they burn about biomass in the amount of 1,800 tons a day. That's a big amount of woody biomass. And nobody can imagine how many trucks takes to deliver that amount of transportation. And the problem that's not in there, of course I am in here to defend the location to schools. I'm not in here to defend how these plants work, as long as they are not built next to a high school. I'm not against these plants. These plants can be built actually next to the forest, where it should be, because of transportation costs. Right now, it takes about $30 a ton to deliver that woody biomass to a plant. In Tacoma, Washington, they received, the utility receives this wood biomass sources of energy, and they get paid $5 per ton. So are they, the taxpayers, willing to subsidize so much? Because why there is this impetus to build by these corporations to invest money on these plants? It's because they will get the woody biomass free. The plant in Dallas will cost $130 million. They will repay that money in a few years. And that's only that. To generate electricity from biomass is very expensive, more expensive than wind. It's a fact. So the utility, the people that uses this type of electricity will have to pay more. There's no free things. And this don't talk about health to people, to students, noise, smells, because once you store this woody biomass, if it gets wet, it creates vermin that's toxic to the lungs. So it's all kinds of problems. When the turbine runs, it creates benzene. Benzene is a carcinoma. These plants are subject to explosions because they are handling methane gas. Methane gas is hard to storage. And that's why I'm in here. I don't have nobody show me, pay me to say what I'm saying. I'm saying just in my own. In my own.
Well, we appreciate that very much, Miguel.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Are there any questions? Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. Thank you.
Larry.
Iron. That will work.
That'll work?
Thank you.
Close?
If Larry, you're in. My name is Larry Irian. I, too, live in Dallas. However, I must say that it was quite coincidence to run into my friend Miguel today. Here, I had no idea. I'd like to preface my statement, if I may, by saying how honored I think we all are by having Miguel speak. You see, he was in the engineering department with Bechtel Corporation for nearly 30 years, and he built small plants to massive nuclear plants all over the world. So he knows what he's talking about. He said benzene and other chemicals and pollutants and so forth. Well, he knows what he's talking about. So it was an honor to hear Miguel speak. Myself, I'm an investor. I don't invest in biomass, and I wouldn't invest in biomass. I have investments all over the West Coast and parts of the EU. And I make it a point not to speak, to give testimony or speak to groups, because I'm a little shy. I get a little nervous when I speak before people. However, when it comes to investing, I'm not too shy. The thing that bothers me about the woody biomass is the high cost and really low return. In some cases, no return for the citizenry, for the taxpayers. It's a very high and quick profitable situation for investors who will make large sums of money, millions of dollars, on one plant, one small plant of woody biomass, by having government, state and federal grants, and state and federal subsidies, tax tax subsidies, et cetera. And so that's one reason why I'm opposed to it. The other reason is something that the gentleman brought up from the Forestry Department, how it will impact the forest. With you, sir, I agree also. However, it must take into consideration roads, bridges, Oregon's future timber, lumber industry, how it will impact that, how the costs of roads and bridges and culverts. To deliver 1,000 to 1,500 tons per day means a lot of trucks on the roads that will impact roads, wear and tear on roads. There again, the impacting the taxpayer. It'll increase traffic lights, et cetera, traffic signals to coming and going of school buses. And since it, from what I read of the woody biomasses, is there is a plan to put them near schools, not only in Dallas but in other locations throughout the state. For what reason, I don't know, but I think which I'm sure you have, you've read where some of the potential locations are, you'll see that they are, in some cases, right next to schools. So I would support an amendment of at least 10 miles from schools. Has a feasibility study been done? Do you know? Does anyone know? Has a feasibility study been done for woody biomass facilities in Oregon?
Mr. Chair,
thank you, Mr. Chair. I've had a woody biomass, a biomass plant that's generated electricity for going on 30 years maybe down in southern Oregon. Quite well, or it wouldn't be there.
Is that the one, White City?
Yep.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with that. I remember when they built that.
I think it's about 30 years.
I was just coincidentally, last week I was in Medford on business for a week, and I heard on the radio advertisements for that facility, please bring your woody biomass. Please bring your lawn clippings and leaves and so forth. We're low on fuel. Please bring it. We can use it. That's the one in White City, all right. So if they're having problems supplying fuel to that, by the way, I did a major construction project down there of a large multiplex theater, and we had to tear down a small shopping mall to put the theater in. And we took a lot of debris out there, and some of it, believe it or not, they wouldn't take to that facility in White City. Why, I don't know. It was woody biomass. So there you are. I don't know what else I can say except that it should be away from schools. And particularly if there's not been a feasibility study, maybe one should be done.
Excuse me.
Mr. Chair, no, I'm ready to move on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for your time.
Hey. Any questions? Is that the... ready? Oh, we're in the public hearing right now. No questions? Is there anyone else who has not signed up to testify on this bill that would like to testify? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 862 and open a work session on Senate Bill
862. Mr. Chair.
Representative Co-Chair Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 862A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Yeah.
President Clem has moved Senate Bill 862A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we want to know whether or not we want to listen to the amendments, or do we have an A3 amendment?
me to reread it?
Well, I think you should explain it to us.
Proposed A3 amendment stipulates that the state forester may not enter into a contract to supply woody biomass to a facility located within 10 miles of a public or private institution for pre-kindergarten through 12th grade or higher education, as well as any facility for the production of synthesized gas, hydrogen pellets, ammonia, mustard gas, or nerve gas. It also defines conversion, and that is the A3 amendment that you have in your packet.
Different bill.
Hearing nothing on that, we will proceed. Any questions or discussions on the motion?
Good bill.
It's in that packet of stuff. Somewhere. That's where I got it.
Mr. Chair, I think this is a great bill, and I'm ready to vote yes on it right now.
Okay. The clerk, call the roll.
Representative Boone?
Aye.
Representative Espinosa?
Are we adopting the...
No, this is just an underlying bill.
There was no motion.
Aye.
Representative Shockler?
Aye.
Representative Stringer?
Excuse.
Co-Vice Chair Cowan?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Johnson?
Aye.
Co-Chair Jensen?
Aye.
Aye.
Having received constitutional majority, Senate Bill 862 is approved to go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there someone who would like to carry this bill?
Mr. Chair. Chair.
Okay.
Representative Clemens has volunteered.
Trying to save my friend down there a heart attack.
You want to co-chair?
Got a carry?
Yeah.
Okay, that's fine. I just wanted to ask a question.
Oh, well, ask a question, too.
On these facilities, that amendment kind of triggered something to me. What about the facility that they're shutting down in Eastern Oregon that they used to take the nerve gas and things like that and destroy it? Could we use something like that to generate electricity or not?
You know, I think...
Well, because they're abandoning the facility.
No, they're not abandoning.
They aren't?
They're going to tear it down.
Why can't we use it?
Because they're under contract to tear it down. That was the contract entered into at the time that the local community agreed to allow them to use it. Okay. You raise an interesting thing, though, in relationship to... types of facilities, while there's still a ways to go and there's always possibility of accidents, considering the volatility of the product that they were burning at that facility, considering the fact that there's been, virtually a minimum, if any, real and known problems, health problems with it. And I would suggest that it's about a mile and a half away the crow flies to a kindergarten school. And it has worked out very, very well. Certainly much better than leaving that particular product there to perhaps blow up some at some time. So the technology, I think, is improving considerably with that. There is discussion that the coal-fired plant out there, I don't know where that's at, but I hear discussion that might be used for that sort of purpose. But the plant at Umatilla, the Department of Defense, as soon as the last ounce of mustard has been burned, it will start tearing it down. And it will probably take longer to tear it down than it did to put it up because of the extensive caution
that went in at the time that it was installed. How it would transfer into, you know, biomass, you know, furnace or not, that's out of my technical ability to enter into discussion on that. So with that, we've closed the public or the work session on Senate Bill 862, and we'll move to our informational meeting. The impact of conservation acquisitions on agriculture in the state of Oregon or any other state of yours. And we have Roger Beyer and Sean Cleave first, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Clem, Co-Chair Jensen. For the record, my name is Sean Cleave, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to discuss the issue at hand today in an informational meeting. This stems from some contacts that both Mr. Beyer and I have received from members in common over the past 6 months regarding the purchase of conservation easements and their impact on the ag infrastructure in the area, the potential impact of property owners who are farming downstream from conservation easements that have been restored to a natural state, and some property distorting values when the conservation easements are purchased at a premium. I won't belabor those three specific issues because I think we do have the members who have contacted both of us regarding this issue, who will go into detail with the committee regarding those issues. But again, I'd just like to thank you all for taking the time to listen today. And with that, I'll turn over to Mr. Beyer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Roger Beyer, and here representing the Oregon dairy farmers on this issue. In addition to what Mr. Cleave just outlined for you, we have another issue that's going on currently, and the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board is currently undertaking a work group or some sort of meetings to talk about how they can better their statutes and make land acquisition, I guess, easier. And that's a concern we have twofold. One is that there's been no landowners that we're aware of that have been invited to participate in those work groups, and I guess we kind of think that we have an important position position that we and opinions we should be listened to. So we'd like to have that for that on the table. But one of the things they're talking about doing is under current law, the purpose of land acquisitions is made for acquire lands that are important ecologically. And one of their proposals is to expand that to not only purchase lands that are important ecologically, but purchase lands that may be next to lands that may be important ecologically. And I guess the question becomes, if you're going to go down that road, where does that end? Isn't all land is next to some other land eventually? So there is a concern that, well, we're seeing this happen already in the farming community, that at the same time we've got a state agency working on expanding on this principle without even asking land representatives to the table. So we'd like to put that on the record as a concern. Chad Allen and Richard Obrist from the Tillamook area are here today to talk about this. They're the ones that first brought it to our attention at the dairy farmers, and the impact it's having in the Tillamook community and the potential impact as farms go or get farmland goes into other uses, the infrastructure suffers. You've got to have a critical amount of infrastructure in order to support farming. So with that, we'd happy to answer any questions at this time, but I'd like to let Chad and Richard tell us about what's happening at the local level, and then we'll be here available for questions after that also. Thank you, Mr. Chairs.
Thank you. Questions for them now before we move on? Chad Allen, and Richard Obrist, would you please?
I'll let you go first. I certainly appreciate you guys having this informational meeting. I'd like to personally thank Chair Jensen and Co-Chair Clem. For the record, my name is Chad Allen, and I'm a young dairyman in Tillamook, Oregon. In the recent last 10 years since I've started dairying, we've continually having little pieces of farmland turned into restoration and wetland projects. And my first thought was, well, they must go through some kind of a review process and get, you know, conditional use to be able to have a land use change. Well, as I investigated that, I found out that the creation, restoration, and enhancement of wetlands is an outright use of EFU. And over in Arnak Woods, you know, we're not losing farm ground from strip malls and hotels and these types of things. We're losing our big chunks of farmland from restoration projects. And I'm certainly not here to say that, you know, that the restoration components in Oregon, there's not some places for that. In reading some stuff from the Department of Land of Conservation District, it outlines all the reasonings that EFU was ever created. And its main purpose was to protect farmland for other uses and to set up criteria that have to be made in order for an alternative land use. Now, within EFU, you have all the outright uses that are pertained to farm practices, building houses on a farmland and other things related to farming. And then you have the conditional use side of EFU, which are non-farm-related issues. Golf course is a great example of a conditional use that's allowed on EFU, but you have to go and receive a conditional use permit, and right now it is not allowed on high-value farm ground. High-value farm ground is described in ORS 215-710, and it outlines all the things, soil types, and areas of Oregon that are defined high-value farm ground by the state of Oregon. And so in Tillamook, we're losing high-value farm ground to restoration projects. And also, as mentioned earlier, different groups that have conservation ideologies and want to undevelop farmland are able to pay higher prices. Sometimes they certainly have an opportunity to take advantage of low farm income periods, you know, when the farming's tough. You know, they sort of have an empty pocketbook and they're able to pay, you know, the top end prices. And once we lose our farmland, it's gone forever. And so what I would certainly ask is that, you know, this particular issue would make the most sense on the conditional use side of EFU so that it has to meet some certain criteria before it goes to an alternative use. And it just makes the most sense to me because in the long term, I, you know, at some point, the Tillamook Creamery cannot sustain operating in Tillamook if it loses too much, you know, and the question is, well, what is too much? We just don't know. So there's been some huge restoration projects up in Bandon. I think one was just completed last summer. One unique thing about up in Bandon, it may or may not be related, but there's no longer a Bandon cheese factory. And so the amount of cows that are being milked up there has dwindled, you know, from where it used to be. So it's no longer sustaining a creamery. And so having a land base to environmentally spread our waste and different things are, you know, something that we have to have in our capital permits and things like that. So with that said, I'd just like to say I really appreciate the opportunity to speak today and for you having this meeting on this. I'll let Richard speak.
Thank you.
Thank you. Richard Obrist. I'm a third-generation dairy farmer up Tillamook. And as I'm here, you know, three of my sons are farming or dairy farming as we speak. And then, of course, six grandchildren, you know, is coming along. Chad did very well outlining, and to follow up, state CAFO allows us, it's kind of normal on 1 acre is about two mature dairy cows. But as we lose some land, the land that we're talking about, for conservation reasons, some of our animals, those that we can milk in our farm, they're left in Tillamook, but our younger animals are shipped out. Some of mine are have been cleared to Walla Walla, Oregon. Walla Walla, Washington, or Milton Freewater. You know, there's a state line that goes through those communities. And that's probably about 7 hours from my farm. And but that's sometimes our only choice, is because when we lose farmland, we're not able to justify any, we just have no availability of the land to farm these young animals. And it costs to have a custom raiser $1.70 at the moment per animal per day. When if I can have my Tillamook grass, it's about, just round numbers, about $15 to $20 per head per month. So there is savings keeping them locally in Tillamook. Every animal that we just don't have the room to keep in Tillamook, then that money's, I'm paying the people up in Eastern Oregon or Eastern Washington, Tillamook County funds, they're getting it in their communities, and we're just losing that monetary infrastructure for fuel, you know, that we've used to farm our farm properties, and things just leave our own communities. When we talk about, I guess I want to say, public money, I know some of our farm ground has been selling for about $10,000 an acre. I've been told, I'm an old farmer in a way, I'm 61, but I don't have $10,000 an acre for Tillamook County farm ground. It's in our financial structure, I guess, maybe $4,000 to $5,000 an acre is what we can come out of pocket or borrow the money to buy a 10 or 20, 30 acres of farm ground. So when it goes into public ownership, say, then we've also lost our tax base for our schools and our fire and our road funds and stuff like that. So I thank you for your time.
Thank you. Question for the gentleman? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. These two fine gentlemen are my constituents, and thanks thanks for making the trip today.
You're welcome.
I had a lot of people here today from Tillamook and other issues too.
Yeah, if you, sorry, yeah. I know we had dairy days here at the Capitol just recently, and it was a fun day. Mm-hmm. So we appreciate your time too.
Thank you, Richard. And so I have to follow it.
Follow it.
Richard is a third generation. He's got three kids. Now he's got six grandkids. Does that permute and keep exponentially growing like that?
Well, and that little one is 2 years old. 18. You know, he was excited when he sees a John Deere tractor. So,
at two.
Yeah.
That's a good sign.
Yeah, very good sign. So, and there is four grandsons and then two granddaughters. So they've all been on the tractors and walked the barns, and, you know, they're old enough to now start helping out. So, I mean, when Chad and I were little, well, when I was little a long time ago, I mean, I was driving tractor at 6 years old. And yeah, those are not the tractors that we have today. You know, the old hand clutches and stuff like that. And I'm, I don't
know. I still have those tractors.
So, you know, like when my boy was 6 years old, my youngest, somebody came, and things have changed somewhat, but somebody had watched him harrowing a field, but they couldn't see him in the tractor.
Because he's so little?
Yeah. And they said, when your son is done working for you, maybe he can come and work for me. And when my son approached that other gentleman, gentleman says, hey, can you come and harrow for me? And he says, does your tractor have a cab and a radio? Things have changed somewhat since the day I was starting out.
Representative Clement.
So and maybe some other speakers can speak to this too, but I'm interested from your experience in watching projects completed, do some of them, what I don't know is by the very nature of the project, if it's impossible to, say, buy it for conservation purposes, but then continue leasing it back to a farmer, or is the nature of it such that you can't farm it because it's underwater or whatever?
Sure, and it just depends. There's a few situations where there has been some pieces bought for winter waterfowl, and then the first idea was that to have no ag use at all, mm-hmm. and then they found that those two things can coexist together because they needed the forage taken off in the summer so that the geese would use it in the winter, because mm-hmm. otherwise the geese are not going to utilize any ground that has mm-hmm. Grown out pasture. And so that is a situation where you can have multi-uses, where you can get your waterfowl habitat out of it. You can get your farming out of it in the summertime because you can't farm most of it. In a lot of areas, you can't have any farming in the winter at all just because you're limited by your ability to get on the ground. Those situations don't always have to end up in loss of private property, though. I mean, there's no reason that you can't have partnerships with farms. I know that in reading some stuff on, I think it was the Winter Waterfowl Comprehensive Management Plan of 1979, had even stated in there that they needed to work on developing relationships with farmers, so that because they weren't going to be able to go out and buy enough ground and do enough restoration work to maintain the waterfowl habitat for the winter that they wanted. So, they mentioned in that document that I read that, and I'm sure since then they've developed some of that, but we know what the winter fall destruction of the geese sometimes they have in the Lama Valley here, and I know that some of the grass seed farmers aren't real crazy about geese, but so
the only thing I can add is we all love our wildlife and that, but when a goose poop pile is put on the land, it's 25% more potent than a cow poop pile. So it's just what has been found. So we, on a cow situation, if we lose this land, or if we could still farm it, we're really not allowed to put manure on it because manure, some people call it, I call it a nutrient, but to some people it's hazardous waste or whatever. So 1 acre of land, once we lose it, there's just no way for the cow or manure application or nutrient application to grow grass. And grass is really needed for vegetative filter strips, and we're finding out that when we're setbacks are so far from the creeks and ditches that there's no grass that grows there anymore. So where we do apply our nutrients, and there's nice grass and filter strips or whatever. So we're learning things every day, but we are pretty darn good environmentalists as far as, if we over-apply or something, we kill our worms. Worms are our best friends out there in the soil today. So.
Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your
thank you.
Testimony.
Thank
you. Appreciate you driving over to Sheriff Builders. Art Schlack and Mark Stern.
Co-Chair Jensen, Co-Chair Clem, my name is Art Schlack. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties. And thank you for the opportunity to be here and share at least a couple thoughts with you. I think you've probably heard both of those. From a county perspective, our interest is one, trying to maintain the agricultural base in our counties that
provide economic viability at this point. So we're very much interested in seeing the agricultural base of the various counties at this point maintained. Sometimes these kinds of easements for conservation and fee simple ownership can have an impact on that agricultural base, and you've heard about that a little bit. The other area that of interest is, needless to say, is the property tax base. Because when land is taken out of private ownership at this point and put into the public domain, then the tax base is adjusted at this point. And so from that standpoint, we're also interested in maintaining as much as possible the tax base of our communities and our counties at this point. That being said, Mr. Co-Chairs, you know, counties are involved in land use issues, Goal 5, a variety of conservation. And so this is kind of a two-edged kind of sword, if you will, for us. But I would just share with you from a county perspective that viability of the agricultural lands is a premium at this point. That we want to maintain, and the tax base is, as you can tell, as and you know, is very much important to us. So thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you. Yes, Mark.
Co-Chair Jensen, Co-Chair Clem, I'm Mark Stern. I work with the Nature Conservancy, and I'm our regional conservation lead in South Central Oregon, which includes Lake County, Klamath County, Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas counties. And I appreciate the invitation this afternoon to come and visit with you about land acquisition, conservation easements, and its relationship with agriculture. I want to give a couple examples of our involvement and engagement with it, but before doing so, just to set sort of the stage, we do own land in Oregon, and as we've acquired land, all the land transactions have followed a pretty simple formula in the sense that it's been a willing seller, a willing buyer, and it's involved a land appraiser and a price that's determined by fair market value. And at most of our preserves in Oregon, we pay property taxes. We pay about $100,000 a year in property taxes to the counties throughout Oregon. As one example of a property in Lake County that involved agriculture in 1980. The Nature Conservancy bought Sycan Marsh, which is a large wetland in Lake County, from the ZX Ranch, which is one of the largest ranching operations in Oregon. At the time of the acquisition in 1980, the purchase included a 40-year leaseback to the ZX Ranch, and that leaseback included an agreement between the both of us to continue to lease land to them for grazing, to allow for a minimum of 10,000 AUMs per season there, and to do that in a way that was compatible and would help us achieve our conservation goals at the site as well. Over the past 30 years, we've worked together to maintain and repair our irrigation and water delivery systems. We have jointly defended our water rights through the Klamath Basin irrigation adjudication process, and today continue to work together to co-manage the property to achieve our goals. We've also spent upwards of several million dollars in Lake County on restoration projects there that's gone primarily to local contractors in Lake Klamath and Harney counties. A second project we've been involved in is in Klamath County at the Williamson River Delta. That was a project that came to fruition in the mid-90s. At the time, Senator Hatfield convened a group of local stakeholders to try and address some of the issues around water allocation and endangered species in Klamath County. One of the outcomes of that group was the recommendation that 5,000 acres where the Williamson River comes into Upper Klamath Lake be restored to wetlands. It had been wetlands historically. In the 1950s, it was converted to farmland, and it was important nursery habitat for some of the endangered fish. From that group, the recommendation was made to have it go into conservation status, and again, we acquired the property from a willing seller. It was a fair market price as determined by an appraisal. And part of the agreement also was two parts. One was that we would continue to keep some of the property in agriculture and that we would continue to pay property taxes there. And 15 years later, we have 800 acres in alfalfa at that site, and we have continued to pay property taxes to Klamath County there. At the Williamson, like Sycan, we've also been involved in restoration, and there's been over 2 million cubic yards of dirt that's been moved in the restoration process, which was at a cost of about $10 million that, again, went mostly to local contractors. Two other properties that we're involved in with agriculture. One is in northeast Oregon at the Zumwalt Prairie up in Wallowa County. We have active grazing with local ranchers there on that site. And then also more recently down in the Springfield area, we acquired a conservation easement. And typically we don't have easements, but in this case it's an easement on 1,200 acres from the Jaquaw family. And we continue to have some logging operations there. We've been removing Doug fir to help restore some of the oak woodland habitats. And so, again, I was offering just a couple examples of how our activities have engaged with agriculture, and be glad to answer any questions that you might have about that.
Any questions for this group?
Well, yeah, actually, I do. Huh? I do have
good.
A question.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cowan.
I'm curious about the property tax issue. I fully recognize the county concerns about loss of property tax base, but I'm hearing you say that you do pay property tax at the same rate, or?
Yeah, we have a policy where we are eligible to, as a nonprofit organization, not pay property taxes to register for that. But at many of our preserves, we have continued to pay property taxes. And we have an internal policy here in Oregon, in particular for counties, and where there's counties with more than 50% federal land ownership, and where the property taxes were on that property were more than 1.5% of the county revenue, we have voluntarily made in lieu of payment taxes. And there's a couple examples of that, one in Crook County, one in Grant County, and I believe in Wallowa County as well. And then there's been other preserves where the one in Klamath County where I gave the example where we agreed in advance that we would leave the land on the property tax rolls and continue to pay those taxes.
I understand. Thank you.
Representative Plain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That the Klamath County one you're just talking about, and you said was it alfalfa, you also continue having some crop is still being farmed there.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we have about 800 acres of alfalfa there at the Williamson River Delta.
So how is the, either in that specific case maybe, but in general terms, how does that type of arrangement come to be? Is it the seller sort of insists on it, or is that part of the mission of the TNC to do some amount, like some percentage we're going to definitely try and, you know, leave either on the tax rolls or, you know, in active agricultural productions to feed people or, you know, what, or animals? How does that end up occurring usually?
Well, in the instance in Klamath County at the Williamson River Delta, again, the genesis of that project was from the stakeholder group that Senator Hatfield had put together. So that included county, tribes, ranchers, farmers, state and federal agencies, and the discussion that we had at that time was not unlike the one that was going on today, and one of the concerns was, okay, land is going to be taken out of agriculture for these conservation purposes. Is there a way to do it that shares the burden, if you will, a little bit? And so that was a particular agreement and commitment on our part as part of that discussion that we would keep part of the property in agriculture. And typically, it doesn't really have so much to do with the seller. In most cases, if it's a willing seller, for whatever reason, they're interested in moving on. But that was one in terms of sensitivity to the community and recognition that that was a concern there and an attempt to try and meet that concern.
And follow-up?
Follow-up.
I have no knowledge of like what the total amount of land in Oregon TNC is working on. So is that just the examples you gave in total, tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of what is instead otherwise wetlands and, you know, non-agricultural related involvement, or is it, you know, a decent, you know, it's not that infrequent, 10%, 20% of the time something like that happens.
In terms of having agricultural activity on some of our property?
Yeah
it's Well, it's interesting. In terms of the number of preserves, it's probably relatively few, but both Sycan Marsh and Zumwalt Prairie up in northeast Oregon are two of the largest ones that probably account for more than half of our land holdings in the state. So.
Interesting. Yeah. Hmm.
Other questions? Hmm? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have Alyssa Leone and Jim Johnson.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Jensen, Co-Chair Clem, and committee members. My name is Melissa Leone, and I'm a senior policy coordinator with the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. OWEB is a state agency that provides grants to help Oregonians take care of clean water, fish and wildlife habitat, wetlands, and natural areas. Our grants are funded with dollars from the Oregon Lottery, federal funds, and salmon license plate revenue. Local watershed councils, soil and water conservation districts, landowners, community organizations, and other local community members get together and decide, identify local resource needs and identify projects and submit grant applications to OWEB. OWEB does offer restoration grant applications. We also offer land acquisition and water acquisition grants. And I'll talk a little bit about our land acquisition grants, our evaluation criteria, and how we do evaluate those proposals. OWEB does not buy land. We do not own land. We give grants to other entities, to eligible entities, to purchase either land or to purchase a conservation easement where the private landowner still maintains ownership of that land, but there is a conservation value and a conservation interest that is protected from that purchase of the easement. We do grant applications twice a year. We evaluate land acquisition grant applications on six evaluation criteria. We look at the ecological benefits of those projects in comparison to some board-adopted ecological criteria and some statewide conservation principles. We look at the capacity of the property manager, which is the long-term owner, to sustain those ecological benefits. We look at the educational benefits of a proposed project. We look at the strength of the partners in the project and the support expressed for the project, often by the local community. We look at the effect of the proposed project on the local and regional community, and we also look at the soundness of the legal and financial terms of the proposed real estate transaction. We have specific application requirements for each of those six evaluation criteria. For example, in the legal and financial terms, we require a fair market value appraisal to be submitted, an environmental site assessment, and a title report and all copies of easements on that property. We look for support expressed by the local community for those projects, and we also asked what the management goals and the management planning goals of the organization are, and asked specifically about the property taxes associated with the transaction and whether those will continue to be paid to the local county or local government. I will say that we have been in discussion. Senator Dingfelder convened a work group to work on Senate Bill 342 to implement ballot measure 76. As a part of that discussion, OWEB put together a work group to talk about whether some of the issues identified through that process were actually administrative or rulemaking issues. And we have had a couple of meetings where we are primarily listening to conservation to our land acquisition grant applicants and recipients about the concerns that they have about our existing process, which was adopted by rule in 2004. We are collecting those recommendations that they're identifying. We will be having a discussion with the full OWEB board in June, and if we decide to adopt any of those recommendations and move forward with them, most of them will be part of a public rulemaking process in which we will put together a rulemaking advisory committee that includes broader interests who have concerns and interest in our land acquisition grant program. We will also be undertaking, under Senate Bill 342 if passed, a more extensive evaluation of OWEB's administrative rules related to our grant processes, of which land acquisition is just one of them. I'll leave it at that and would be happy to answer questions.
Thank you.
Co-chairs Jensen and Clem and committee members, for the record, my name is Jim Johnson. I'm the Land Use and Water Planning Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I kind of been asked to bat cleanup on this simply because I've probably been dealing with this issue off and on for 20, 30 years, working with farmers and ranchers around the state. And it's not an easy issue. You really can't, for lack of a term, regulate land acquisition, and so the issue is as much more than just acquisition. It's ultimately a land use issue in terms of what can or can't be done with the land, regardless of the ownership. I would point out that when you look at the issue, it's not just about easements. It also relates to fee title, and also deals with what some people call purchase of development rights or transfer of development rights. So there's different tools that are utilized to achieve conservation potential or conservation policy issues on resource lands. When you when it comes right down to it, though, there's three key issue areas that has been my experience as it relates to agricultural operations, and I'll just go through those three if you can indulge me there. The first, and you've heard something about this, is the conversion issue, and conversion by that is agricultural land being in effect taken out of production and put into another use. I would also suggest to you, because this is becoming a greater issue, that conversion is not just an issue dealing with land, but also with the water rights that go with the land. And once that land is taken out of agricultural production, those agricultural water rights are also in danger that might be going with that land. They may no longer be available also. And so you're dealing not only with a land-based critical mass issue, but a water-based critical, a water supply for agriculture issue. That critical mass or infrastructure issue, and you heard Sean Cleave talk about that, really gets to, and it's a hard thing to measure because agriculture is so diverse in this state, but it gets to situations like how much land is needed to support a critical mass of farmers or ranchers or the like to support an irrigation district. How much is needed to support a co-op or a creamery? How much is needed to support the other agricultural infrastructures in an area? And that's a really hard thing to measure, but it's an issue that we deal with all the time. And it's not just specific to one area in the state. I've dealt with this issue all over the state, including urban agricultural areas. When you talk about conversion, the other issue that doesn't get discussed an awful lot, but I hear about from farmers, and it came up a little bit in regard to the gentleman from Tillamook County talking about the cost of farmland. And that's the ability of farmers and ranchers to better develop or expand their business. Agriculture is one of the few land uses in our planning program that doesn't have a 20-year land supply plan for growth. Mm-hmm. Urban growth boundary cities and like, they get to plan for 20-year land supply, usually on the backs of agriculture. Agriculture grows not necessarily in terms of land area, but by farmers being able to acquire, rent, or lease land from other landowners in an agricultural zone. So as less of that land becomes available, there's lesser opportunities for the farmers and the ranchers to expand. Moving on to the second issue area, and that's compatibility or impacts to surrounding farms. When you look at an acquisition for conservation purposes, whether it's a land ownership or an easement or the like, a lot of times there's an awful lot of discussion dealt with in terms of how it relates to the subject land. There's not an awful lot of discussion related to what's the impact of surrounding farming and ranching operations. And I hear issues everything from impacts to drainage patterns to trespass of water from a subject property onto surrounding farms to attractants. And it was brought up earlier, but one of the biggest complaints we get year in and year out as it relates to right to farm are noise cannons. That's directly related to geese. And more times than not, what we find out are the geese are new to an area because of something that's attracting those. And one of the biggest examples that comes up to mind is the Basket Slough Wildlife Area. That area, as it's been converted back to wetlands, yes, there's a lot of geese there, but there's also a lot of geese on the surrounding farms. And when the farmers try to deal with that, they use the noise cannons and the like, boy, do we start to get the complaints from the non-farm community out there and the like. And so it kind of just snowballs. Other compatibility issues stem from weed management, public trespass. I will tell you that in the Portland metro area, I hear more comments from the farmers up there dealing with acquisitions not from land trusts, but from public agencies, whether it's metro or state parks or somebody like that. And once that acquisition is in the middle of an agricultural area, you've just increased the public access to the surrounding farming area. And so you start to get issues with liability, trespass, vandalism, theft, and the like, and the ability to buffer your land from surrounding operations because now that land itself that was in agriculture, which might have provided a buffer, is no longer available. So those are kind of compatibility issues that we hear about. It was brought up earlier about the conditional use versus the no review use, and I want to save that to the end in terms of possible suggested solutions or the like. But the third issue that comes up an awful lot, and it relates as much to and Melissa talked about it a little bit more, and that's the credibility of the acquisition itself. To OWEB's credit, they've really started to develop a list of factors and the like that really points them to the appropriate types of land that may need some type of conservation practice. But to be quite honest, there's an awful lot of acquisition that goes on out there, especially as it relates to working lands, that I would call opportunistic as opposed to strategic. In other words, whoever's the first person to come up and offer their land up for an easement or acquisition, it's acquired, regardless if it's under any threat, regardless if it's under has any real natural resource value. And the ag community a lot of times can live with credible acquisitions when there's been legitimate criteria used to decide where those are going to be, where they'll be compatible with agriculture. Are there alternatives? It's not. There may be able to meet the same principle that you're looking for, but be on lesser value ag land, for example. In other words, alternatives. Representative Clem's heard me talk about alternatives time and time again on land use things. Well, it kind of relates here. So the whole idea of making acquisitions that are based on opportunity versus strategic is another issue that the ag community talks about an awful lot, and it's an issue that even the federal government's talking more and more about with their federal programs related to easement acquisitions and the like. I will point out that acquisitions are not just made by private entities, they're also made by public, whether it's a metro, a state parks, even the federal government in some cases or the like. So it's there's a wide variety of different people that are involved in it. I'll end with just a discussion of a little bit about the land use side of it in terms of the I don't know if it's the term would be solutions or not, but I've worked with Representative Clem off and on over the years in terms of some of these issues that relates to land use. Chad Allen talked about this a little bit. When you look at the structure of the exclusive farm use zone, there's two real sets of land uses within that. And I'm not going to try to be too planning wonkish here because I can do that sometimes. But there's the first set of uses in the exclusive farm use zone that are subject to review against state standards only, established in state law. And in the case of wetlands and restoration, enhancement, and creation, for example, they fall in this category, and there are no state standards listed at all in the exclusive farm use zone. So in other words, they're permitted with no review. The second set of uses, which some people call conditional uses, are subject to review criteria established in state law and any criteria that local governments may want to authorize. So possible solutions to requiring some type of land use review to address some of the issues that I just talked about would be either to leave, I'm just going to use wetlands because they're the obvious one, but there's other conversions that go on, is to address a use as in that first category of land uses subject to state law only, but ensure that the criteria that they're reviewed against in state law addresses conversion issues and compatibility issues. And that can be done. There is precedent for that. There are uses that are listed in that sub 1 category, like utility facilities that are subject to state law but not local, and they do address compatibility with agriculture. The second is what was suggested by Mr. Allen, and that is a conditional use permit, and basically the only real difference to that would be is what, in addition to the state standards, it would be whatever local standards that local government would want to apply there. There's pluses and minuses to that. Those can be more political sometimes, and that can be a good or bad thing depending on what side of the issue you're on. So I've taken a very complicated subject and crammed it into a real short amount of time, and Mr. Chair, I'll leave it at that and answer any questions.
Thank you. Any questions?
Sure. This one. Representative. Thank you. So for OWAB, you mentioned you've got some stakeholder group already that was meeting in response to a Senate bill, and then there's either ongoing that same group or some new one. Have they or will they include, you know, people like those folks who are just sort of private landowners in the area? Are they always just, you know, other agencies, nonprofits, associations, things like that?
Co-Chair Clem, when the group right now is largely involving some of our land acquisition grantees, those folks who are most familiar with our process and have the most criticism about our process, as we move into this part is supposed to end here in June. Starting July 1, as we're starting to implement ballot measure 76 and the implementing legislation, we will be doing a larger scale look at our granting processes, granting priorities. We know that land acquisition will be one of them, and any changes that we make will be through a rules advisory committee, and it's our intent to involve sort of the broader stakeholder community. It might be landowners, might be representative of the Farm Bureau or the Dairy Association.
Okay. Mr. Chair, one more.
Well,
Jim, you talked a little bit generally about our past efforts. I forgot. In our big EFU uses reform bill last session, what was the initial proposal we were making around these types of issues? I remember state parks came in here and just whined considerably that they didn't need to be subject to our bill, but I forgot what other people said.
Co-Chair Clem, the proposal that was in that omnibus EFU bill that you had proposed, one of the elements I remember, for example, established wetland creation or enhancement as a conditional use in the sub 2 category. It also required parks to be reviewed under more scrutiny for protection of agricultural land. Most parks are reviewed as sub 2 uses now under current state law, but there's no review criteria established in that state law that deals with compatibility with farmland other than 215-296, which is the amorphous compatibility thing, but it doesn't really get it at alternatives, looking at alternative lands and the like.
And if I follow up, Bo, and I remember hearing some specific concerns from Washington County growers about Metro's acquisition outside of their boundaries and whether they would be, you know, not taken care of, essentially bought, let sit in a completely natural state. Would they be leased back to farmers? And it seems like Metro also opposed really their being involved. They kind of liked, largely it was if you already had the land use system in a way that you didn't have to do, you know, those kinds of processes. It seemed like most people in this arena, in this particular topic arena today, opposed any changes to what they currently had to do.
Clem, I believe that that's correct. I mean, I don't specifically remember Metro's response to the bill that you had drafted, but I've worked off and on with farmers in the Metro area, and including the Nursery Association, on a lot of the issues with Metro's acquisitions. And you're correct, they can acquire lands outside an urban-influenced area all the way out to outside their jurisdictions within the three-county area. And the ag community has always been concerned not only about lands just being left in a natural state and not managed for their impacts on the surrounding lands, but that public access issue also. They're very concerned about trespass and vandalism and the like. And we even had that one situation I think that you're familiar with that was out near Banks where some land was left to be flooded and it started to impact adjacent agricultural lands with floodwaters and the like. So those are all legitimate issues. To Metro's credit, They have discussed coordination with agricultural interests, including ODA, in the future when they start to look at other acquisitions such as that. And I haven't had any experiences with that to date because I don't think there's been any new proposed acquisitions since those issues came up.
One more? I'm sure the committee will want to leave soon if I keep asking questions, so, or already do want to leave. Anything in the current statute for conservation purposes differentiate soil types or, you know, capabilities to produce, you know, at any level, any kind of test? Because, I mean, I think part of the general land use philosophy that you know, probably most Oregonians share is, if it's really good for growing food, since we're going to have to grow more food in the next 40 years for the earth than we have in the previous 8,000, that's good. And then there's debates about around whether we're culling stuff that's not really good for growing food farmland, and that's where the debates seem to occur. But the pure 1 and 2 soils, impossible to replace, most people seem to think that's at least good to protect. Do we have any differentiation here in this particular area between Class 1 and 2 soils, for example, and the rest, or Class 1 through 4 and the rest, the way we do in certain other categories of use?
Chair Clem, state law doesn't really deal with the acquisition of conservation easements or the like more than enabling certain people to do it. It doesn't establish much criteria, if any, in that or whatever. It enables, you know, for example, ODA is enabled to hold a conservation easement if we so choose to. We don't own it. I take that back. We do hold one for a soil and water conservation district who had some issues with management. But it doesn't really address one way or the other criteria for what types of land should or shouldn't. That's left to the entity that's involved in that. It's the land use program, and when you start to talk about how the land will be used, that starts to make a distinction between high-value farmland, for example, and non-high-value farmland. Mr. Allen talked about golf courses. They're permitted on EFU zone, but not on high-value farmland. Creation of and restoration of wetlands, there's no distinction between high-value farmland and other high-value farmland. I don't know why somebody would want to take high-value farmland and put a wetland on it when you're looking for a hydric soil in the first place. On the other hand, there are a lot of hydric soils that have been drained and converted to agricultural land that are still technically hydric and are supporting high-value crop production.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Seeing no further things, we will close the public informational meeting. And with that, we are adjourned.
We meet on Monday.